This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Julia Trust-Reeve. How are you, Julia?
Very well indeed, Chris. Good to talk to you again.
Excellent. Last week we were talking about all the different activities and what's going on in the vineyard. This week I just want to talk a bit about some of the styles and some of the things that have been happening in the industry since in the last few years since I interviewed you last.
Yeah, well, an awful lot's happened, even in the short time since we last spoke, Chris.
Yeah. Talking about that, let's talk a wee bit about wine styles. For me, last year, I had a revelation. It was the Simpsons Roman Road Chardonnay. And I haven't been to English wine, the trade tasting, for a couple of years. But my experience was that the Chardonnays, when you're making a Chardonnay, they were not very good. And particularly for the price you were paying, they were pretty awful. And then last year I went down to Canterbury for our holiday, just a wee mini break with my family, and we popped into Simpsons and we bought a few of their wines, and yeah, we tried them and they had some nice sparkling wines, but their Roman Road Chardonnay was like, oh my god, this is like a proper oaky Chardonnay with lots of finesse, lots of acidity in it, lots of finesse. And it tasted really good. We used it in a load of tastings afterwards. And it was one of those wines that it wasn't for everybody. But if you were a person who knew your wines, and particularly if you're a Burgundian fan, they were just going, oh my God, I can't believe that you can make wines of this quality in England. And I was really impressed because usually English wines can't take much oak because they're too light in nature, really. Is that something you're seeing more of than before, or?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm seeing that there's been a real revolution in what's going on with still wines. We've been very, very lucky in that we've been blessed over the last 3 years, particularly with very, very good ripening conditions. We've had great years. And I think one of the turning points was 2018, where we had our biggest crop. But it was also deliciously ripe fruit as well. And it just lent itself to producing some phenomenal still wines. And what those producers who, in some cases, probably set out to just produce sparkling wines from the traditional varieties, actually saw the opportunity with some of the ripe fruit that came in from Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. And some really wonderful wines emanated from there. And that continues. And actually, last year, we had a much smaller harvest. But again, probably some of the ripest fruit some of our producers have ever seen. And very excited to taste what 2020 vintage is as well. I think part of it is this wonderful confidence that we've now got in our industry and our producers, and a real understanding of the capabilities of the fruit that's now grown. And, you know, we've now got some very, you know, identified areas where the fruit grows magnificently. And the North Downs and the South Downs are two examples, not the only ones, but two examples. And actually, if you're growing in the right conditions, in the right parcel of land, with the right clones, and you're also blessed with the kind of conditions, weather conditions that we have, then you've got yourself a really fantastic mix. And that's not to say that it's only reserved for the very best years, but it just means that it's enhanced a little bit more. We must not underestimate the talent that's out there with the winemaker. They really understand what's coming out of the ground, and they work with it, and they're prepared to experiment. I think that's what's exciting.
Let's talk about, you said some grape varieties. I think most people understand English Bacchus, pretty good stuff, a bit like a New Zealand Savvy. I've actually had a few that have had a few years of age on them now, mainly because they've been hidden in the rack for a while. And I wouldn't say they age well, but they don't age badly. You know, you can have a Bacchus 3-4 years old. I think I had a Chapel Down Bacchus the other week that was about 4 or 5 years old. The acidity had backed off, but it was still holding together. It doesn't go like a New Zealand Savvy where it goes all canned peas and horrible and overblown flavours. It just, the acidity actually comes right, whereas, because sometimes it can be a little bit in your face sometimes.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, actually, a lot of these, you know, like a Bacchus, I would say that actually most Bacchuses that are produced are made for drinking young, where you've got that really fresh, vibrant acidity, and you've got that lovely, crunchy, gooseberry, herbaceous, grassy fruit. But actually, and you said yourself, you know, one of the best things that sustains our wines is the acidity. You know, we have it, so let's make the most of it. And it, of course, will sustain the wine for just those few extra years whilst the fruit is allowed to develop. And I personally find an older English wine develops some quite nice tropical fruit characters. You know, it becomes more kind of apricot-y. And you know, they're really interesting. I mean, another area that is being produced much more of now is rosé, and of course that's a very popular style. And we don't just produce one particular style. You know, the popular trend, of course, is for the sort of the paler kind of Provençal style colouring and stuff. But actually, you know, depending on the grape varieties you use, and of course we don't just use Pinot, we actually use a whole range of different wines, and also you know, blending red and white grapes as well to produce some really interesting, lovely fruity styles. We've got fruit, you know, and we've got acidity, and you can produce a really lovely dry, crisp wine, be it white, be it rosé, and, you know, actually red. I mean, Chris, you'll remember tasting English reds a while back, and my goodness me, there's been a real revolution. Again, it comes back to just what our winemakers know they can do with our wines. And there are some fascinating Pinot Noirs and actually some of our Rondos and Triomphs and things like that too.
Yeah, I can't comment about English red. I went right off it and I went, no, there's no way I'm touching that with a barge pole. So I would only ever taste English reds and English trade tasting where I don't have to pay for it.
I urge you to try some recent Pinot Noirs, because they've been an absolute eye opener. And actually, we had our Wine GB Awards judging last week, and we had some phenomenal judges from the world of wine. And I think without exception, all of them commented on the quality of the reds and how they've come on. Much to look forward to. Chris, we'll have to make sure you come to the trade tasting this year and you'll taste a few.
Yeah, we'll see if there's a lockdown or not. We'll see. But yeah, maybe I'll have a little look at the reds again. But I got well put off them.
Well, again, you know, 2018, I think that again gave the opportunity for winemakers to show just what you could do, you know, with red grapes for red wine. And actually, I was tasting a couple of wines last week. One was 100% Pinot Noir from 2018. And the other one was 100% Pinot Meunier from 2018. Now, Pinot Meunier is a really interesting grape variety over here.
As a red.
And there are some vineyards that, yeah, and it produces some fabulous, soft, fleshy fruit, which actually works really well on its own. So expect to see perhaps a few more of those as well.
Okay. One of the things that came out this year was Balfour Lynn's Rosé in a Can, which is a carbonation, so it's a still wine. They pump some pumping the bicycle, as the Frenchies would say, where they've carbonated it and then put it into a can. So it breaks all the sort of traditional winemaking techniques and a lot of what Wine GB has stood for in the past. How do you guys feel about these sort of new wines? Because there is a risk that it might devalue the high end. So is there a big internal conflict about this, or is it everybody's just like, whatever?
Well, I mean, I think we're really lucky because we can embrace innovation more than perhaps any other wine regions in the world. You know, we're not stuck with, you know, with a strict set of rules that kind of hold back on innovation. And actually, we've known for ages, as the industry has been growing, you know, there are all sorts of new styles and new methods of winemaking or different methods of winemaking that people are embracing, and actually canned wine is one such example, and you know, Balfour Hushheath are not the only ones to produce a canned wine. Three Choirs have produced some for a while. You know, we've got the Uncommon, which actually has been written up many, many times by people, and I know there's another one, Narnia's Vineyard, which is actually over Wine Week, actually I think is going to be crowdfunding to produce another style in a can as well. So actually we love innovation, and it's not just cans. You've got Crevery, you've got Amphora, you've got, you know, you've got all sorts of different different methods of production to produce different styles. When Wine GB was formed a few years ago, back in 2017, one of the things that we did recognise was to really look after that which we hold the most dear, which is our, you know, classic method sparkling wines, traditional method sparkling wines. And so we launched quite a you know, quite an intensive project over the course of last year to look at that, to kind of, when I say protect it in the sort of in the best sense, not all strapped up in legislation, but just to recognise it, and in so doing, actually to recognise everything else that went on. So this was not making it utterly exclusive, but about 2/3 of our production, 70%, is sparkling wine made by this method. And there are other methods of production that are now coming through for sparkling wines as well. So we needed to hold on to that and to have that recognised. So we came up with the Great British Classic Method so that we can refer to wines produced by that means as classic method. And we've got a visual device, and now more and more producers are going to be putting that on their labels so people can recognise that. Actually, you know, for some of the other styles coming through, brilliant. It's entry level, isn't it? You know, it means that people can actually perhaps grab a bottle or a can or whatever of wine that's produced in England or Wales and actually get to know it a bit better rather than going straight in at top end, which some people might feel a bit nervous about doing, and then work their way up. You know, I know of one winemaker, you know, who said, look, a lot of people who've been to visit his vineyard, you know, they say they drink Prosecco, but they start trading up in time. And it's just another example of what we're doing. But it's really important that people kind of understand and recognise what we produce and what the sort of price differentiations are. It happens in other wine regions. I think in California it does. And you don't actually have a too much of an issue. Consumers do recognize the difference between the high-end stuff that is premium and quality, high quality, and you've got the others that's perhaps more entry level, but recognizing for what it is, which is a fantastic glass of wine. So we hope we can do the same thing.
Yeah, I like you calling it entry. It's still pretty expensive stuff at the price point.
You know, I mean, actually, if you're going to pay 10, 12 quid for a Prosecco, you can spend 12 quid on a bottle of English, English fizz, you know. Yeah. And I don't have a problem. And actually, the cans are brilliant. You know, I think people have been talking a lot more about what to take out on a picnic. And hey, isn't a can much more convenient? And they're good quality, but they're different from our very serious wines that are now absolutely directly in competition with champagne as an alternative. You know, I find it very enlightening and lovely to see people say, "Look, I had a bottle of English sparkling wine the other day. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. We'll go out and get it. We'll spend a bit of money on that because we recognise it for being a very special wine that it is." And that's lovely. Great to see.
Okay, before we finish up, just let's go through a couple of stats here. How many vineyards are there now in the UK?
In the region of 800. Now, that ranges from, you know, 0.1 of a hectare, which is pretty tiny, up to some of the biggest ones in the country. I mean, actually, 75% of the hectareage now is grown on, or sort of grown, you know, at vineyards that are sort of say 5 hectares and above. But the majority in number terms, you know, you've got a lot of sort of 5 hectares and below, or 10 hectares and below. So you're around about 800.
Okay. And there's a lot less wineries than vineyards. Yeah. Is that because there's a lot of contract growers? Is that the situation?
There are quite a few contract growers, but you know, a winery is a pretty sort of pricey business in itself.
Needs a lot of skill as well.
Exactly, a lot of skills. So you'll actually find that quite a lot of these wineries will obviously be contract winemaking for others. Or as you say, some vineyards will sell to, you know, will sell their grapes to some of these larger producers as well. But those wineries, yeah, about 178 of them, you know, do range from very, very small operations to some big ones. And actually, we've now got sort of, you know, contract winery that doesn't have vineyards, but they actually will make wine for smaller vineyards. And that's great because smaller vineyards, you know that you're taking your grapes to a really good professional operation that will make good wine for you.
Well, in the old days anyway, you had Ridgeview did a lot of contract, and who was it? Dermot Sugrue. Who did he work for?
Yeah, Whiston. He still does.
Yeah,
he makes a lot of wine under contract as well. Three Choirs, they manage a lot. Hackney Green. So they're doing a fantastic, you know, they've got a fantastic operation, each of them, to serve our community of vineyards.
How many bottles do we make in the UK, roughly?
Well,
because it depends on the weather, isn't it?
Well, there is no such thing at the moment yet as an average harvest. I mean, you know, you can take a 5-year average if you like, but it doesn't really reflect the year. So, you know, for example, 2018, we produced just over 13 million bottles. That was our biggest ever. It was 10.5 million in 2019. And then last year, we only produced 8.7. We're not worried about that because, in fact, we know that of the 8.7 million bottles, there was phenomenal quality. We just had, you might remember last year, it was so hot. We didn't have a great deal of rain. The bunches are much smaller, added to which we had late frost, which actually hit quite a lot of vineyards last year. So, you know, quality over quantity every time. So, yeah, I can't really say an average, but, you know, when you and I perhaps first started talking, the average, you know, was, say, what, maybe 5 million bottles a year. That's definitely grown if you're going to take a more recent average.
You guys have got a target, haven't you, of X number of bottles or something? I remember.
We said we could be. I mean, I don't think we're necessarily setting ourselves the absolute target. But yeah, by 2040, we'll be selling 40 million bottles, Chris. But, you know, there's an awful lot of growing that's been going, as I mentioned a little bit earlier. So we're going to see the fruits of those labours over the next few years. And we're pretty confident, you know, we're building new markets. The domestic market is the strongest by far, but actually exports, is another big target area for us. And we know that there's demand out there. And those few that export have certainly been seeing a very comfortable rise in sales, which is wonderful. Principal markets, US, Japan, and actually Norway, in fact, Scandinavia as a whole. But Norway actually held up very well last year, which was great to see.
Why Norway? Is it because of the market? If you can get into the, I can't even pronounce then what they are.
Yeah, it's the monopoly. Yeah, I think so. And they're sold in sort of high-end restaurants and retailers and things. And it kind of just works very well. I think the palate over there is very, really likes it. And it's been really good to see how those sales figures have been going up.
Cool. And just before we finish up, you're talking about the Wine GB Awards. I presume it'll be after this show's gone out, so you can't tell me who won.
I can't tell you who won, unfortunately, Chris, no. We're really excited about the Wine GB Awards. So we've always had a competition in our industry for many, many years. But about 5 years ago, we revamped it completely because we just wanted to make this a much more consumer-friendly, consumer-facing competition. And we were so lucky in that we have Susie Barry, MW, and Oz Clark as our co-chairs, and they select a really stellar lineup of judges to reflect different aspects of the trade, if you like. So this year we had Hamish Anderson from the Tate restaurant group. So we've got the sommelier side of things. Helen McGinn, who's a fantastic broadcaster commentator. We had Beth Kelly from Majestic, so we've got the retail side. Simon Field, who's he's an international judge and obviously worked for Berry Brothers for many years. And Rebecca Palmer from Corney and Barrow. I'm terrified I've left someone out, but I think I've got everybody there. We had six judges on each day for 2 days, and it went through a really rigorous process. And they do not give out medals willy-nilly. Actually, there's sometimes quite a hard argument that goes on about whether it should go up to gold or whether it should stay as silver. So, you know, Oz, I think, has put it very well in the past. And you can see it on our YouTube channel. And I think that we'll be putting some new stuff up because we filmed it last week. But, you know, he said, look, if you get a bronze medal, you have really achieved something. Move up to a silver, congratulations. You represent something quite phenomenal within that category. Gold medal is just, you know, fireworks and bells and whistles, and you've just done brilliant because that is a hard battle, a hard fight through. And then trophy is the best of the best of the best. So, they've done something. And this year, I particularly wanted to flag it up because, A, we're announcing pretty much all the awards on the 24th as part of English Wine Week. So that's not just the medals, but most of the trophies, because we have category trophies. Susie and Oz are going to be doing an IG Live that night to talk about the results, to discuss it all. I think there are going to be some great stories to tell from it. One big story, we think, is many more new entrants. And I think, again, this is just showing what the industry is doing. We've got all these wonderful new vineyards and new winemakers who are doing great stuff. So I think there might be some lovely stories there. And we'll have our first wins that have got the Sustainable Wines of Great Britain logo on it as well, because we've now got a wonderful sustainability program, SWGB, Sustainable Wines of Great Britain, and the first accredited wines from the vineyards and the wineries are coming through. So expect to see a little bit more of that as well. So I think there'll be some really lovely stories, actually. Aren't we lucky to have this band of wine experts assessing our wines? And they've said some extraordinarily positive things about the wines. And given that they taste wines all over the world for their job, it's wonderful when they say things like that about our wines.
Lovely. Okay, then, Julia, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chris. Lovely as ever to talk to you. It's been fantastic.
Cool.